G'day folks, and welcome to Stick With It, APA's podcast for its pilots. Now, whilst in a perfect world, we can all would like to go through our aviation careers free of an incident, that is rarely the case. So we thought it was a good opportunity to explore what happens following an incident, so you as our members have a greater appreciation of your role and responsibilities and how the wider flight ops community and APA as your association will be involved. I'm very grateful today to have with us three people who are well-versed in this area. We've got Captain Chris Roop, the Fleet Safety Manager from Qantas. We've also got Captain Debbie Slade, who is the Fleet Safety Captain and who is currently battling a very sore throat. So it's appreciative that she's here with us today. And we've also got APA's Safety and Technical Consultant, Brian Greaves. Brian was a former Cathay Pacific Captain and now works for APA as a consultant. He's been involved with the safety and technical portfolio for many years and has sat in on many safety interviews as a support person for our members. So welcome to all of you. Now, I'm sure that our members are aware of their roles and responsibilities following an incident, but probably more from a theoretical perspective. So we're going to try and flesh that out a bit today from a more practical context. It's important information to provide the following caveat that every situation is different and the information we are providing today may not suit every situation, but it hopefully will provide you with a guide. I guess regardless of whether we're talking about an accident or an incident, we'll assume that most likely the crew will eventually end up in an airport terminal and the passengers will be under the control of ground staff, and then you'll end up with the operational debrief of the cabin crew would have been done. So I guess to Chris to start with, at this point, what should the crew do in terms of who should they contact?
Yeah, well, hi, Mark, and hi, everyone. The first point of call following an event would be to phone the IOC. The IOC is always the first place to go. The IOC can then phone in anyone who would be needed. You know, typically post-event, the duty captain would be phoned in. There may be a duty safety rep, Deb, myself, or there's a few others. They could also phone in duty medical officer, corporate comms, the MOC. It'll really depend on the actual event itself.
Okay. What will the crew likely be directed to do at that point?
The first thing the duty captain will do is check on the crew's welfare. That's always the most important thing following event, to make sure the crew are in a safe space. Following that, the crew will be asked to give a brief rundown of the event, just containing factual information about what happened. And that might be used, you know, for example, by the duty safety person to report to the ATSB if there's an immediate ATSB reporting obligation. You might get asked a few questions. Did you declare a PAN, a Mayday? You know, did you use oxygen if it was a pressurization event? Might get asked to check that an operational debrief has taken place.
Yep.
Following that, then the crew might be directed to remain at the airport while it's determined if damp testing is going to take place.
So normally, you know, from a domestic perspective, they may have other sectors to do. So at that point, I'm assuming that they'll be advised, you know, don't go pre-flight for the next one. You're probably at that point, you're more going to be advised either to cease operations or potentially sort of hang around for a damp test.
Yeah, absolutely. If damp testing's determined to be required, and you know it's required by CASA under certain events, accidents, serious incidents, the duty captain will make that determination and inform the crew of that. It's very important then that the crew don't conduct any safety sensitive activities, and that could be, as you say, conducting a pre-flight for the next sector or similar. Also important to remember with damp testing, this is one that happens occasionally. Maybe due to something that wasn't really had the direct involvement of the crew. For example, a loss of separation event where the crew didn't do anything wrong. It could be an ATC error. You might end up being damp tested after that.
My understanding is it can often take quite a bit of time for the damp testing team to arrive on site. Is there a preferred place for the crew to wait?
The crew would be told by the duty captain how it's going to be managed and what to do. Depending on where it is, yes, there can sometimes be a wait. The crew most likely will need to be under observation during that wait as well. So the most typical thing we'd see is that we would engage the airport manager to look after the crew. You probably end up in the airport manager's office. If it's one of our bases here in Australia, you might be down in the base office with your base manager or base performance manager.
Yeah. And what about, I mean, you could be going out to Jimbata or, you know, somewhere, you know, out in the middle of nowhere. If something happens in that place where obviously the support services are less, is there still the capability to be damp tested and to sort of be supervised? Is that still available?
Ideally, yes, there are going to be some circumstances where damp testing isn't going to be possible, and the CASA documents sort of allow for that. Essentially, you'd be removed from all activity for 36 hours if damp testing wasn't able to be conducted.
Okay. Once the test has been performed, who needs to know the results? Is it, are you then free to go home you get told the results eventually, or how does it work?
Again, back to the IOC and the duty captain. So once you'll be informed of all of this by the duty captain on the day, but once you've got those results, phone them back into the IOC and the duty captain, and they'll let you know what the next steps are.
Okay. Now, obviously, obviously depending on the nature of the event, the crew could be shaken following the incident and might not feel comfortable driving home. So just a small thing, but I'm assuming can they get a cab charge or use a cab charge to get home and then come pick up their car in a couple of days' time when they're feeling okay? There's no pressure on them to drive home?
No, absolutely, they could do that. Yep. As I said before, post-event, crew welfare is the most important thing, to think about.
Yep.
You touched on it before that a crew might have to, they might be partway through a duty and they might have more sectors. So it's also really important at that time, you refer to crew being shaken after an event, that you've got to consider your own fitness to fly. Certainly the duty captain will ask you that if you are happy to continue operating a duty where you're partway through a duty. But you've got to remember the shock from an event might take an hour or so to set in. Yep. You might still be running on adrenaline. So really important for the crew to consider whether they are or aren't fit to continue operating. I can assure you, you'll have the absolute support of safety and fleet operations if you make the decision that you aren't fit to continue operating. And on that topic as well, just bear in mind, crewing might, their job is to crew aeroplanes. Yep. You might have a look at your roster online and see that you're now scheduled to operate something.
Yep.
That's probably done with the best of intentions, but absolutely coordinate all that through the duty captain.
Okay, no worries. Now, should the impacted crew make notes of the incident as soon as they can, for their own recollection later on? Do you have advice? I mean, again, they're potentially stressed or, they could well even be suffering from shock, but is there any value to trying to jot a few things down, whilst it's fresh in your mind?
Yeah, at an appropriate time, absolutely. We'll try and do the interview as quick as possible, but it could be a few days. And again, while you might have a great recollection on the day, once the adrenaline's all worn off, perhaps you're not going to recall things as well as you expected. So jotting down some notes at the time can be really, really useful, yeah.
Okay. So, if the crew go home or their pack's home and, they end up at home, who then makes the decision about whether the impacted crew sort of is withheld from service and what's the time frame normally to make that decision and how are the crew notified of that?
So the decision to withhold a crew from service is made by fleet operations. Typically, it'll be, the fleet manager narrow body or wide body as applicable, in conjunction with the fleet manager standards as well. The decision is made as soon as possible, bearing in mind that sometimes, again, depending on the nature of the event, all of the information might not come to light immediately. It might take some time for the fleet manager to get all of the required information to make that determination. Where a crew is withheld from service, they'll be notified initially by a phone call from the fleet manager,
yep,
possibly from a base manager as well, just depending on the time of day and who's available. That will then be followed up by written notification, which will come to the company email address, just informing them of withheld from service and how the process works. It's worth remembering the primary reason that a crew might get withheld from service following an event is actually for their own welfare. It's a stressful time, and we don't want crew to be in a position where they feel like they have to continue to go flying while they might be distracted or stressed by an event that's happened to them. The other reason as well is just to facilitate the interviews. If someone's got a packed roster coming up, we obviously, as I said, want to interview as soon as possible. So it might be the most appropriate thing is to withhold them from service to facilitate those interviews.
Yeah, I was just going to say it feels as if, people might view it as punitive or they've done something wrong when that's not necessarily the case. It's more just it's probably the conservative position that the company takes to protect the pilot impacted as much as everything else.
Yeah, absolutely.
Clearly, this has the potential to be a very stressful time for those impacted. Who is available from both the company and then to Brian from APA to provide support to the pilots at this time?
So from the company's point of view, you've got your base manager and your base performance manager being your direct managers. They're always available for contact. The fleet manager is there as well. They'd be a good point of contact if you're questioning how the process runs following an event. Then more broadly, there's the employee assistance program, who've got a few different methods, including counsellors and psychologists, et cetera, depending on the nature of the event. PAN is available as well. And then I'll hand over to Brian for APA Welfare.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris. And hello, Debbie and Mark. So I think if we just take a step back first, Mark, it's important the members understand that on the website we have three documents which are really useful. And I would suggest everybody download those because they give them a really good outline of what to do in the event of an incident. And they really mirror a lot of what Chris has already said. So when they work through the process, they'll either, when they contact APA, they'll either get through to the schedulers out of ours, and Bob and Dave are very well versed in taking those calls, calling it, or they may get through to APA office, in which case it will come down to safety and technical. But one of the first things that we will make sure is that the welfare department are contacted. And as you know, we have some really great people in welfare, again, very well versed in how to deal with situations. They will, to the best of their ability, take care of the people involved. It's also very true to say that when somebody is stood down, it's probably the first time in their career that's actually happened. And indeed, often when people are involved in these incidents, that's the case. So we really, really recommend that contact APA as soon as possible, and we will make sure that you have the welfare and assistance that you require.
Yeah, and my understanding is that I think, having spoken to some pilots, that they think that potentially the company will let APA know, but my understanding is that it's up to the member, the APA member, to determine if they want assistance from APA. And as Brian said, if you go to the website www.apa.org.au, that lists all the best ways to contact APA, so then they can get the ball rolling, and then obviously they can provide both the welfare and then the safety and technical support that you need.
Yeah, that's correct. So if I could just cut in there.
Yeah.
You know, in that document, you see the as you work down through, there are a number of things that, you know, to protect the individual, to get them away from anything that could, inverted commas, be bad for them. And then the first thing that they're encouraged to do is to contact the company in the way that Chris has described. Underneath that, then, is to contact APA. And the moment they contact APA, then everything goes into place. But if they don't contact APA, sometimes, you know, we're trying to do it, but the last thing we want to be is ambulance chasers. So please, please, if you're involved, after you've contacted the company, please contact us.
Okay, that's great advice. Thank you, Brian. Now, if a safety interview is required, how long, and I know that it would vary, but how long does it normally take before this is organised? And who can our members expect to hear from the company's perspective, Chris?
We try to organise it as soon as possible. Obviously, it's in the best everyone's best interest to get it done as soon as possible. It's going to depend a little bit on where the crew are at the time. Yep. Obviously, different if they happen to be in their home base on a weekday versus if they're upline somewhere and it's a weekend. But I would say typically within 24 to 48 hours of the event, we'd have the interviews organised with the crew. Who can they expect to hear from the company's perspective? Look, quite a few people for varying reasons, which could be your fleet manager. As I said before, you know, if you are withheld from service, your fleet manager is probably going to be the first point of contact you'll have. Your base manager or base performance manager is likely to get in touch from a welfare point of view. And then either myself or Deb is likely to get in touch to organise those interviews.
Are members allowed to bring a support person along to the safety interview?
Yeah, absolutely. As Brian said before, when I call a crew or any of us call a crew to set up an interview, we always make sure in that call we reiterate that they are allowed to bring a support person along if they wish. What's really important for me is that the crew member is comfortable. So it really is whatever they're most comfortable with.
Yep.
On the safety side, there'll always be two people in an interview, an interviewer and a scribe. So, you know, it can provide a little bit of balance there if the crew member has someone along with them as well.
Okay. And invariably, are they face-to-face, or given the world we now live in, are often these meetings done virtually?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. Pre-COVID, they were typically face-to-face.
Yep.
I think what COVID taught us all is that we can actually work remotely really well. So typically these days, the vast majority of our interviews are via Teams or similar.
Okay. And Brian, can you explain in a bit more detail the role of the safety person from APIS perspective? Do they and what do they provide? Is it support before, during, and after the interview, or what is that role?
I think the first thing to understand is that all the people that are representatives have undergone training. So it's not just, you know, somebody turning up and saying, hey, I'll come along as your mate. So after they've gone through the course, they normally do an observation. Chris and Debbie are very good in allowing us to do that. So we have the support person, but we'll also have from time to time an observer so that they can get the experience of it. So once they're trained, then the member is called APA. Then whoever then is allocated, normally by Maggie, to be that representative will make contact with the crew member. They'll have an icebreaker, I guess we'll call it, allow the crew member to explain what has occurred, and then explain to the crew member what the process is, what's likely to happen to them, but most important, to take care of things like why you stood down, why the interview may be delayed in taking place, what will happen afterwards, why it may be that the company will say, we'll get back to you on Friday, but because of situation, it may be Monday or Tuesday, and so forth, and then go through what the likely outcomes are. From our perspective, we always will support that member right from the beginning until the outcome is known, and even beyond that, if required. Chris made a really important point. At the end of the day, it's the wishes and what is best for the member that is paramount, not necessarily what is best for the company or is best for APA.
What are some of the potential outcomes that can occur from the safety interview? And I make reference to the term just culture, which I know is listed on the documentation from the company with regards to safety investigations. And I guess I'm interested in what some of the outcomes can be and how the just culture framework sort of fits in with those interviews and the outcomes.
Yeah, so we know no one goes to work to make a mistake, right? We're all human. We all make errors. I'm still trying to do the perfect sector. It hasn't happened yet. So the principle of just culture is it acknowledges that human error is normal and human error is inevitable. And when it happens, that the crew member is provided appropriate support, you know, for example, retraining. So following a safety interview, a formal just culture review is conducted, and that involves the safety investigators, fleet managers, and an expert HF facilitator. And that facilitator uses a formal process known as the just culture tool to run the just culture review. And it sort of seeks to break down the actions of the event and assess those actions to see if they were the expected, desired action, or if they were sort of unexpected or undesired action. And if that's the case, were they influenced by, you know, an organizational failing or shortcoming, or was it a human error, or was it a behavioral choice which the tool classifies as an at-risk behavior or a reckless behavior? Once that review is complete, fleet managers then use that to determine the return to work pathway for the crew. And, you know, that's really a fleet managed process, but obviously a return to work pathway could be straight back to work. It could be a chat with the fleet manager. It could be simulator retraining or something more, you know, more lengthy than that. If people want more information on the terminal, there's an aviation psychology and human factors site that has got a lot of information on just culture.
Okay.
Including the actual just culture tool that is used, so you can have a look and see how the whole process is run.
Now, I'm sure those of you with me today, you understand, you know, how the impacted crew will feel very stressed during this situation. How much is your focus on trying to have these crew members return to the line?
Yeah, so post-event, I think there's two things that we're really focused on in that short term after event. The first one is putting in place any immediate safety mitigators to prevent the event from happening again.
Yep.
Sometimes it's immediately obvious what we need to do. Sometimes it takes a long time, but it may well be that an INTAM or a safety information notice could be issued within hours of the event if deemed necessary.
Okay.
The other thing is the focus on getting the crew member back on roster. It's in everyone's best interest that that's done as soon as possible. We know that the crew member wants to just, you know, put an event behind them and get back to flying. So certainly that's our desire.
Okay. And Brian, in terms of, you know, once even the person has returned to the line, is support is still available through welfare if the person's still working through the process? I mean, obviously, they are free to stay in contact with APA through that process.
Absolutely, and people do that. And likewise, we will, if we feel that the member is maybe struggling, we will take the initiative and contact them. Let's try to go back a little bit to what Chris said. First of all, as part of the training, we go through and we do the Just Culture tool. We use a presentation that was produced by Louise, who really introduced the Just Culture in many ways into Qantas, so that everybody has an understanding of what the Just Culture is and how it's going to be used. And why we need to know that as representatives is because when the outcome comes as a result of the process that Chris has described, we need to be able to say to the member, look, this is reasonable. Obviously, returning to line is the best thing as soon as possible, but it may be that there is appropriate remedial training. And the stress is the remedial training appropriate? So we don't want somebody to have to go and do another command sim as a result of things. But if we say yes, that's fine. We encourage the member to accept that decision. And that's sometimes very difficult for the members. So we kind of work through, but at the end of the day, hopefully we can persuade them this is the best way. If that's not the case, and this is very, very rare, we will refer it to the legal department. But at all times, as said before, the members' wishes are paramount.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for that additional context. I know that sometimes, an incident could also then be investigated by the ATSB. How will the affected crew members be made aware of this?
So any ATSB comms coming to Deb and or myself, so we would contact the crew member to let them know that the ATSB had informed us that they were commencing an investigation into the event, and we then provide the crew members' details to the ATSB who'll organise the interview process. On that topic, it's worth pointing out as well that we had an event recently. It was a loss of separation due to a light aircraft. Our crew just got sent round by air traffic control. They were none the wiser that anything had really happened.
Yep.
And then the ATSB commenced an investigation. So, it is possible that even if you're not really aware that an event happened, the ATSB could commence an investigation and request to interview the crew.
Okay. And are there many differences in style, I guess, between a Qantas safety interview and an ATSB interview?
No. The interviews will follow exactly the same process. Recent interviews I've seen from the ATSB have been remote as well via Zoom or Teams or similar. The crew member will be offered to have a support person just like they are in a Qantas interview. So, yeah, from the crew member's point of view, very similar.
I would say, if I could, Mark, I'd say that Please. There are a few subtle differences. Whilst the interview in many ways is conducted in a similar way, we call the cognitive interview style, the member, and we make sure that this occurs, is summoned under the Section 32 of the Transport Safety Investigation Act. Why is that important? Because of what it means is they're protected legally, and whatever they say there is protected by that act. In a Qantas interview, Chris will tell you that the support person is trying to write again. Sorry, they have two people, and there's one who is a scribe, I think Chris described it as, and often that they're working really, really hard to keep up with whatever the interviewee is saying. In the ATSB, they've made the determination that they're going to record the interview. And because they record the interview, we need to make sure that information is protected, okay, which is under the Act. In addition, the support person also has to sign a section of the TSI Act. So I actually attended the interview as a support person for the incident that Chris was describing. If I now were to discuss with you the details of what went on there, I would be committing a criminal act. So the whole point of the ATSB is find out what went on, make safety recommendations. And we're really lucky in Australia because nobody's trying to allocate blame. And as a result of that, we will learn from it. And hopefully the similar incidents are not repeated.
And that's actually probably, I guess, one thing I forgot to ask was that I'm assuming in both the safety interview in a Qantas situation or with the ATSB, they're just wanting the pilots, is it literally just a recollection of the events that occurred in it, or are they also looking for the person to make an assessment of causal factors or editorialising a bit, or is it very much just tell us A, then B, then C, then D? I mean, what's the style of interview in terms of what are they trying to get information-wise?
I think definitely just that we want a free recall from the crew members.
Okay.
What do they remember? But we find that a lot of crew, because, you know, that's part of our makeup, a lot of crew will have already worked out what went wrong and why. We see it in safety reports quite often that the crew members will go, and the reason this happened was because we were distracted by this, and then that happened, and that happened, and that happened, and they've pretty much done a safety investigation themselves.
Okay.
But obviously we've got access to a lot more information, i.e. flight data, CCTV footage, etc. So we can start building a bigger picture and come to conclusions that might be slightly different from the crew members' recollections, because they've only got one piece of the puzzle, I suppose. But definitely that free recall is the main part of the interview. And then they might find that the interviewing team will start honing in and pick up on some nuances and start asking some more directed questions around, you know, how did that happen? You know, which checklist did you use? How did you run the checklist? What did ATC say, et cetera? So then they'll start sort of narrowing down some of those lines of questioning.
Does the stress of the event sometimes make it hard to remember? I'm just curious for people who are like, yeah, their recall might not be quite as accurate as what they thought it was just because of the event?
Definitely. We find that, especially with unstable approaches, we find that crew, the majority of unstable approaches probably maxed out, they've reached their threshold of cognitive capacity. So their recollection of the event normally doesn't agree with the flight data. And that's just because of compression of time, et cetera. So they'll say at 500 feet, this happened, and it was actually at 200 feet or 100 feet. So we find, especially with unstable approaches, that the recollection from the crew is actually quite skewed, not on purpose, but just due to the nature of the event.
Yeah, I think that's important that, you know, it's not if it's different, they're not, I'm assuming, again, you guys don't view them as lying. It's just sort of, it's more that, you know, just the stress of the event can cause that difference in perception, I guess.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So one of the things you mentioned, Mark, is making notes, and we suggest to people to make notes. So, and often when people come back, I've been absolutely amazed, I'm sure Chris is the same, is the amount of detail sometimes crews are able to go into, you know, phenomenal detail. And likewise, Chris, the interviewers, will make notes, and on the basis of that, they'll produce their safety reports. We observe, and I've observed a lot of Qantas interviews now, and nobody's out to try and catch anybody out. You know, as Deb says, things happen, and people's recollection, you know, for all the good human factor issues can be distorted. One thing we make sure of, and Qantas is really good at this, but not so maybe some other companies, is to introduce the flight data after they've got the recall. So this is what I think happened. This is my perception. Now, it's interesting because the flight data is actually saying something different to that. Introduce the flight data at the beginning, then all of that really rich information has gone away. And again, stressing on what Chris has said, the focus is on systemic, you know, are there organizational issues? And at the end of the interview, the interviewee is invited to say, and many have said, you know, the manual was misleading. The MEL didn't really explain to me. This procedure wasn't as it should be. So the organization learns, but from time to time, you know, all of us make mistakes. Sometimes we need to have some additional training. And that's why we also look at, or the interview looks at the individuals. And that's why we support them through there. If for any reason we believe that Qantas is going off the rails during that interview, we will intervene. And Chris and his interviewers know that that's going to be the case.
I was going to say, Brian, so just to, before we sort of wrap up, during a normal interview, is the role of the support person really more there as an observer? They're not actually sort of an active participant in the interview?
Correct. If everything goes to plan, basically it's introducing yourself and then at the end thanking the people, and then that's it, and then making almost immediate contact with the person being interviewed to find out how they felt about it and to discuss any things and to alleviate as much as possible any worries that they have. But from time to time, you know, there may be something from your own experience or something you feel that the interviewee has missed. And that's the time that we can prompt them and say, maybe you'd just like to say to Chris about this. And they go, oh, yes, that's right. I remember this is what happened.
Okay, no worries. Look, I think that's it. But if there's anything else either of you would like to add to the discussion, I'll just go around, I guess, maybe Chris first and then Deb and then Brian to finish. If there's anything you'd like to add, please.
Yeah, look, I think it's interesting because the only thing I was going to talk about is what Brian was just mentioned himself. So it's good to see we're on the same page. But just to point out, the purpose of a safety investigation isn't to assign blame to any individuals. It's to learn from the occurrence. And what we're looking at is things like, you know, how was the training set the crew up? How are our policies and procedures? What influence might fatigue have had on this event? So just really want to stress as a safety department, we're looking at the organisational safety, not the individual.
I haven't got any, no, I don't think I've got any more to add. Yeah, I just do want to reiterate that, you know, we're not out to, you know, assign any blame to an individual. We really just want to learn from an event. And I know that all the people that come in for an interview probably don't feel that way. But that's definitely our primary aim, is to learn from the event and also to make sure that it doesn't happen again. So, you know, as Brian said, you know, there are emails that are written poorly or there are manuals that are written in a misleading manner. So these are our opportunities for us to fix it, and that's our job. That's my team's job to do that.
Okay, thanks very much. And Brian?
Okay, first thing I'd say, we have a very good working relationship with Qantas Safety, and both Debs and Chris are very flexible. They really do support us in bringing coming along as representatives, and they will even move the interviews so that can be done. The final thing I would say to the members is please go to the website, look at the documents that are there. They're really useful. Download them and have them available. And finally, if you are involved in an incident, please contact APA as soon as possible at your earliest convenience. And likewise, as soon as Chris or Deb, whoever has advised you the date of the interview, please, please let us know so that we can be there and support you.
Thank you very much. Well, thanks, yeah, to Chris, Deb and Brian for joining me today. We trust this has provided you with a clear understanding of the process and who you can reach out to for support during what may be potentially a daunting moment in your career. You know, APA has a lot of experience in supporting members through events like this. I think it's one of the reasons why we often focus on EAs as a reason to be a member of APA. But, you know, there's the elements of welfare and S&T where support is there. And sometimes it's, you don't know you need it until you do need it. And then you really do need it. Please feel free to reach out to APA and we can provide you with the support. So just as a reminder, our office number is 028 307 7777. If you need a call for an emergency, the number is 028 307 7788. And for any welfare issues, please call 028 307 7766. That's all we've got time for today. We'll be back with another episode soon. But in the meantime, fly safe and stick with it.